So, hi Don, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today. We're really excited to pick your brain and learn about some of the things you've picked up over the last 25 years of coaching basketball in your 4 years as an NBA player development coach working with players like Tim Hardaway, Rajah Bell, Bruce Bowen, Rasul Butler, and other NBA players.
Well, I appreciate your calling. Anytime I have a chance to talk basketball and hopefully share what I know with anybody, I really enjoy those opportunities.
Yes, and we definitely appreciate that. So, and yesterday we had some interesting conversations. You and I talked for a while, and you brought up some really interesting points about the mental aspects of the game that I know would definitely help both players and coaches. And you also opened up my eyes to some coaching aspects that I think a lot of coaches would really benefit from. Particularly, you mentioned how teaching is such an important aspect of coaching basketball. And you mentioned that you disagree with many of the tactics that coaches use today. So if you don't mind, let's start talking about how to teach the game of basketball. Then maybe we can work into some of the mental aspects of basketball that we also discussed yesterday. And so why don't you tell me about the teaching aspect of basketball. How should coaches be teaching their players?
Well, I'm not sure that disagree is the right word. I mean, I've just discovered different methods that as I went along, I found some non-traditional things that have become that I really wish that I knew earlier in my career. And I don't profess to know everything about teaching. I only know what has been really successful for me, especially over the past few years as I've gotten into better and better players and I've been able to make connections and make significant improvements in players on an individual basis, dealing strictly with development. But I know that I've seen a lot of changes in the way that people teach basketball, the technology that's involved and the additional pressure that's put on coaches and the decisions, whoever make these decisions, that playing has become more important than teaching the game. As a matter of fact, last summer there was a summit that involved all the top basketball people in this country, and it was actually international, but Mike Krzyzewski was involved, David Stern was involved, George Ravlin from Nike was involved, Jerry Colangelo from USA Basketball, and several other people. And they did an extensive examination of the way that we treat basketball in this country. And they have determined, not that they are the be-all and end-all of all basketball, that kids in our country spend too much time playing and not enough time learning how to play. And the results of that have been poor play in international competition. When you look at players around the world, they just seem to be much more skilled in the fundamentals. While they may not be as athletic and they may not jump as high and they may not run as fast, their level of fundamentals seems to have surpassed ours. And I think a lot of that has to do with style of play. There's a trickle-down effect from the NBA that most NBA play now is isolation and matchups, and that's not the way the game was invented, and that's not the way it's played around the rest of the world. So I've tried to isolate some of those things in my teaching, and I've learned a lot of things. I've probably learned more things from the players than they have learned from me. One of the things that I learned in my teaching background, because I do have two teaching degrees, is that stress affects the way people learn. And I've observed, especially high school coaches, and I've seen them in there. A lot of high school, as we know, a lot of high school coaches are teachers as well. And I've observed them in their classroom, and they're just outstanding teachers. Mm-hmm. There's two-way conversation. There's nurturing. There's help through problems. And then when they get on the basketball court and they're coaching them, now all of a sudden they become authoritarian and they become dictators.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having kids learn, having not just kids, but anybody learning something new is stressful enough. Okay? Fear of the unknown and lack of confidence really retard growth.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have coaches that are on the floor that are only interested in controlling what's happening between the lines and not really interested in growth, what you do is you wind up stunting growth. It's like that old analogy that if you're on the beach and you pick up a handful of sand, the tighter you hold on to the sand, the tighter your grip is, the more the sand slips through your fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great analogy when it comes to coaching.
Right, and you're also driving some of the players away because it's not as fun when you're somebody's telling you what to do all the time.
Absolutely.
In a dictatorship, in a sense.
Absolutely, because coaches, who are coaches' role models? Coaches' role models are guys that they watch on TV, and TV tends to gravitate towards the more colorful characters because it creates more interest in their viewership. So you see somebody on the sidelines that's standing up and yelling and screaming all the time. Coaches believe that that's the way they're supposed to act. But when you think about it, first of all, the referees don't listen anyway. And a guy is coaching in an arena that holds 20,000 people, and he's yelling at a player that's all the way across the court and on the other end of the floor. The chances of that guy even hearing him are slim. But that doesn't stop the coach from standing up and yelling and screaming on the sidelines. And I go to youth games, and I go to junior high school games, and I go to games where kids have limited practice time and they're just learning the game. And to see the way recreational and youth coaches treat their kids, I think is very damaging to basketball and to learning. So I've learned to adjust my teaching to try and make some positive effects mentally. And as a result, once the skills catch up, not only is there a steeper learning curve, but kids are more comfortable. They're more comfortable performing the skills, and they're more comfortable when they fail to perform the skills. They don't lose their confidence as much. I'm a big believer in the great Far Eastern thinker, Yogi Berra. Yogi once said that 90% of the game is 50% mental. And I think he underestimates. Bobby Knight once said, mental is the physical, is 4 is to 1. And I think he underestimates. I think that the number one thing in trying to teach kids how to play, and this is when I use the word kids kind of pejoratively, but it's the same thing I do with my pro guys, is you have to make them comfortable with what you're trying to teach them. Because trying to perform new skills is stress-inducing anyway. So anytime you can reduce the stress and find a way for them to reach success while enjoying themselves, they're going to progress much quicker.
So what are some of the...
Just as an illustration of that, is that when I first started my coaching career, I became a head coach on a college level when I was 30 years of age, which is relatively young, and it was probably too young.
Yeah, that's definitely pretty quick.
But I went out my first several years of coaching, and I was a general. I was Patton. And we were very prepared and very, very fastidious in what we did. And somebody had taught me, don't show your kids your practice plan because they're going to find the places where they're going to goof off. Now, seeing that that was one of my role models, I thought that's what coaches were supposed to do.
Right.
But as I went along, I found out that might, at least for me, and I can only speak from my experience, coaches have to do what they're comfortable with. Okay, but at least for me, I found that over time, that was not the healthiest thing for me to do. First reason is that I demanded so much of my players that if they had any thought of taking time off during a practice, I didn't want them in my gym.
Mm-hmm.
So if I thought I had that inside my players, then I picked the wrong people.
Mm-hmm.
But the second thing I found, and what I wound up doing, I wound up posting my practice plan both in the locker room and in the gym. In addition, my assistants having copies of the practice plan. If a player wanted to know what we were going to do, they're supposed to tell them. And we would start every practice with, all right, guys, here is what we're going to work on today.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that really, really lowered the stress level in practice, because while there are things that kids don't like to do, there are things that kids do like to do. And they're much, much more willing to get through a difficult drill that causes a lot of stress and a lot of problems with kids if they know coming right behind it there's going to be something they're going to be successful at.
Right. So not only did you let them know what was going to happen and keep them involved and feel like part of what's going on, you also mixed up your practice plan so it was maybe a really difficult drill and then followed up by something that was a little more enjoyable and not so difficult.
Well, we hoped to make all the drills and everything we do in practice, we hope to make them all enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
But
what are some of the things that you've done to make those drills more enjoyable for players, and some of the methods you've used that's worked well to reduce stress?
Well, the first thing we did is we removed negative reinforcement. I don't think that a kid makes more layups because there's a threat behind the layup that if he misses, that he's going to have to run suicide.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think that that's a productive situation. If a kid can't make a layup or continue to miss layups, we would have him practice more layups.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? We stopped penalizing losing teams and started rewarding winning teams when we played for competition in practice. Now, functionally, over time, that may generate out to be the same thing. But there's a big difference between allowing a team to take an early water break because they have more points in a drill than the other team, than putting the losing team on the baseline and having them run a suicide.
Right.
Because you want people to cherish success more, and I'm different in this regard. I want people to cherish success more than they fear failure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think that when you start to fear failure, that is when you start dealing with pressure. Pressure is all self-induced. And if you have no fear of negative ramifications, I think you perform better. Okay. Now, coaches will say, well, if you have no negative ramifications for actions, then how do you control them, and how do you get kids to do the right things?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you want, first of all, a lot of that has to do with interpersonal relationships, and a lot of that has to do with the way that you teach and the value system of the people that you have in your gym. Okay? That everything has its own intrinsic value, and players have to want to be successful, and then you reward them for success. And the ultimate reward is getting on the court for the game.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to spend an enormous amount of time, too much time, punishing people. If you're not going to do it this way, then you're going to run. Well, when you do that for punishment, first of all, how hard does a kid really run? What does he get out of the running? I mean, it's not really good conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Builds up animosity between you and your players. If it's done during practice, the other players are not working while you're punishing a particular player. And if you're one of those people who believe, as I do, in team rewards and team penalties, If you're punishing your entire team because of the actions of one or two people, not only do they build animosity towards you, but they build animosity towards one another. I used to be a big believer that if you had 11 good kids in the gym, that you're going to live with one or two bad ones. Mm-hmm. And we made everybody responsible for one another. And when the kids that were not responsible would act irresponsibly, then the whole team would be punished because we believe that the 11 kids, the 11 good ones, should exert pressure on the other two. But you know what? It didn't work that way. What happened is that consistently the two who were irresponsible would drag one or two or three other responsible kids down the tubes with them. So now you're not talking about 11 and 2. Now you're talking about 8 and 7.
Yeah. So what do you do about that?
And the other thing that you're doing is you're removing the reward for the kids that do what they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if a kid missed class, okay, we had when I early in my head coaching career in college, we had a rule that if you miss class, everybody runs for the guy who missed the class. Well, the dean's list students who went to class 10 minutes early sat with the teacher for 20 minutes after class would come to me and say, where's my reward for, you know, why, if I'm going to have to run anyway, why should I go to class?
Right.
Now, you hope that you have high enough character kids to realize that you go to class because, number one, it's the right thing to do. Number two, that's why you're in school. And number three, it's because that's where you're going to learn. And that's all well and good, but the kids who are responsible students will continue to go to class. But the ones who are on the fence will stop going because they're going to wind up running anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So after one practice where we did almost nothing but run, I realized that we didn't make anybody better. We didn't address the problem. The team itself suffered, the responsible ones and the irresponsible ones. We didn't do anything to make the team better. We didn't do anything to make individuals better. And it was a wasted day, and it was a day we were never going to get back.
Mm-hmm.
So I become of the mind that when we get into practice, we are going to do whatever it is we need to do to get better. And if you are not going to be responsible for what you do, you're either not going to be on the team or you're not going to play. And that was the penalty because I no longer believe in punishing the good with the bad.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes,
sometimes
when you're only punishing the irresponsible players, the responsible players get punished anyway because it makes the team weaker.
Right. So in essence, you focus on rewarding positive rewards overall, and then the only real negative punishment is, well, if you don't try to get better and you don't work on these things, you're not going to play, or you're just not going to be on the team.
Yep.
Those are really the only two negative.
And those are things that are, I mean, sitting a kid down, having him not play is not really a hard decision, but
mm-hmm.
it's a really difficult decision to sit face-to-face with a kid and say, you're not fitting in with everybody else, so I can't have you on this team.
Right, because ultimately you want to help these kids and,
yep.
and you know, make them better people
yep.
and better players and all around. So
yep.
that's definitely a tough thing to deal with.
But when I deal on an individual basis, when I deal with kids, the first thing that I try and teach them is you can't fear failure, especially when you're learning new skills. And one of the examples that I use is I'll go to a junior high school kid, and I'll ask him, have you ever heard of quantum physics? And I don't know why I picked quantum physics, but it's always quantum physics. Have you ever heard of quantum physics? So invariably, the kid looks at me, and he says, no. I said, so if I asked you a question about quantum physics and you didn't know the answer, would that upset you? So he says, no. I said, why not? He goes, I have no idea what quantum physics is, so I don't expect to know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
So I carry that over to basketball and say, we're going to do a drill where you're going to dribble two balls, and you're going to put one behind your back and one through your legs. If you can't do that, is that going to upset you? He'll say, yes. I said, why? Well, it's going to upset me because I want to be a good basketball player and I want to be perfect in everything that I want to do. And if I can't do that, it's going to bother me. I said, have you ever done this before? He says, no. I just look at him and say, quantum physics. So that if it's a new skill, if it is something that you've never done before, if it's something that you need to learn, you can't be upset because you're not able to do it the first time or the second time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Each time you lose the ball, all it is an opportunity to pick it up and try again. Because if a kid fears failure, he's not going to go pick up the ball again. He's not going to try again.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to remove that fear of failure when you're trying to teach new kids new skills at any level. Second thing is you have to explain to them, and you have to do it in different ways depending on age groups, is that when you learn a new skill, and let's say you have a kid who has poor shooting form,
mm-hmm.
okay, and you're trying to correct his shooting form. Effectively, what you're doing is you're not correcting his shooting form. You're teaching him how to shoot anew. So you're teaching him a new skill all over again.
Right, which is very difficult.
Yes, and we also have to understand that it takes once somebody has a habit established, it takes three times as long to reestablish that habit in a different manner. So for every one shot player takes in his old form, he's got to take four in his new form.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes a long time, and there's a lot of frustration. But in varying ways, depending on the maturity and the age of the kid and what they're able to comprehend, you have to teach them that you have to be able to accept short-term losses for long-term gains.
Exactly. That's a very important lesson. If you can get the kids to buy into that, that's a huge part of the game in teaching. Because we all have so many kids that you get as a coach that don't shoot right. They don't have proper footwork, and they just have so many bad habits they developed as young kids playing basketball when they're 5 years old and growing up. That there's so many things like that to fix. So,
but one of the mistakes that we make as coaches is that when we see a kid like that, we just say, here, do it this way. And we don't take the time to teach him not what he's supposed to do, but what we are doing. Okay? We don't take the time to teach the kids that the reason why we're making this change is because in the long term, you're going to be better than where you are now. All we do is we say, move your elbow in. So what happens when a kid tries it your way? If he goes 2 for 10, and this is another analogy that I use with kids. Kid goes 2 for 10 from the foul line, and you go and you try and correct him. And he goes 1 for 10. The next time he shoots 10 foul shots, what is he going to do?
He's going to think it doesn't work.
Yeah, he's going to go back to his old way because the greatest motivator is success.
Right.
So he's saying, whether it be consciously or unconsciously, I'm making 2 for 10 my way. I only made 1 for 10 your way. Why should I do it your way? Well, we have to teach players why that is. And you may be only making 1 for 10 today my way, mm-hmm. and you're making 2 for 10 your way, and that's fine. 2 weeks from now, my way, you're going to be making 3 out of 10. Your way is still going to be 2 for 10. 4 weeks from now, My way is going to be 5 for 10. Your way is still going to be 2 for 10. 6 weeks from now, my way is going to be 8 for 10. Your way is still going to be 2 for 10. So you have to get kids to buy into things that they have not experienced yet. I mean, that's pretty much the definition of faith. It's belief.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, it's belief without proof.
So, yeah, and everybody wants instant gratification. So that is a very, very important thing to explain why you're doing it and what they're going to get in the long term. That's definitely a good.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen kids. I've coached so many players, and I've seen them develop from 10, 11, 12 years old into pro ranks. So I have an idea of how a kid progresses and how they develop within their skills. Well, you're trying to teach a 13-year-old, his only frame of reference is he's 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He has no idea what he's going to look like when he's 15, when he's 17, when he's 18. So you have to develop a relationship with that player to take it on faith that I've seen enough players that have progressed from 13 to 18 that I could predict that if we get this straightened out, by the time you're 14, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah. Using other players as examples is great proof to get them to believe they can actually do it. So, yeah, if you got those examples, those are good things to mention as well.
And the other aspect is I believe in teaching people a lot of things away from the basketball court.
Right, you mentioned that yesterday with, like, the shooting was a good example that you got, that you gave, that was pretty interesting as well.
That the object of shooting is to do what? Is to put the ball in the basket.
Exactly.
You're trying to work on shooting form at the basket. No matter what you tell the kid after 4 or 5 shots, if the ball's not going in the basket, he is not going to believe that he's doing the right things. But if he throws the ball up in the air, hits it with his head, and it goes into the basket, he's going to believe that that was good.
So what do you do about that?
Well,
solve that problem.
One of the things that I do is I work on form, not only away from the basket, but if I get a kid to work on form in his living room, I'll do that. That we start with kids sitting on chairs and just trying to get the ball straight up in the air. There's a drill that I do early where we work on shooting form where he's supposed to shoot the ball as high as he physically can and have the ball come directly back into his hand without having to move his hand and catch it one-handed, because if it has proper spin, it's easy to catch.
Mm-hmm.
That you could do at home. That you could do in the living room. You could do it in the garage, in the backyard. You don't need a basket.
Right.
Eventually you progress to standing up and then standing up while you're shooting and standing up and jumping and doing the same thing and then shooting against the wall. Because when you do it at a basket, as long as the ball goes in the basket, your shooter believes that he's done well.
Right.
And we've both seen players where a kid throws a shot in from an ungodly place without even looking at the basket, and you turn to your assistant and you say, "That's the best shot that kid could have hit." Because now he thinks he can shoot, and we know he can't. And so the more he shoots, the better off we are. And we've all been through that. We've all
started. Oh, yeah.
Another real big thing that I try and encourage, especially younger players, to practice is footwork. I really believe that the basis of your game is in your feet.
Mm-hmm.
When I work on shooting, arm technique and that sort of thing that everybody else works on, I work maybe 10% of my time. I don't want to sound too much like Yogi Berra. The other 50% is footwork, and then 40% is mental. But I believe that the biggest part of your game in any aspect is footwork.
Right.
So we do certain footwork drills. And I encourage kids to go home and grab a chair, because most of my workouts involve chairs,
mm-hmm.
and do the same workout that we just did on the court, just do it without a ball, and use the chair as reference points.
Yep. So they can get a, they can work on footwork right in their own house without even.
They can work on their footwork while they're walking to school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just working. So when you walk to school, instead of walking straight, try reverse pivoting up the block. Of course, you have to do it when nobody else is looking because people are going to think that you're nuts.
Yeah.
But try inside pivoting. Try drop stepping.
Right.
Okay. When your mom calls you for dinner, okay, make step turn moves on the way into the kitchen.
Right. So it's definitely important for players and coaches, for that matter, to understand footwork of the game, because that's going to help you not only in shooting from the perimeter but scoring in the post, to getting rebounds, to getting past your defender, you know, off the stationary move. I mean, footwork is in almost every single aspect of the game. So,
and it's the same footwork. All of a sudden, there are only a certain amount of things you can do on a basketball court. It's the angle and the theater and the context that you put that in that determines what you're doing. An inside pivot to get a shot in the post is exactly the same pivot as a drop step pivot to box a man out.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly the same. Okay, a V cut to get open on the wing is exactly the same move as a crossover dribble. An inside pivot on the post is exactly the same as an L cut to get the ball on the wing.
So it makes sense to work on that stuff and get good at pivoting in those footwork moves,
yeah.
Definitely.
And what
so they'll help you in all aspects.
Right. And what it does is it helps your players with their confidence level because they don't have to relearn new things. Because, again, we already discussed how trying to learn new things creates stress.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you've been through inside pivots in the post. Kids are comfortable with inside pivots in the post because they're shooting the ball. Now you want to go to rebounding. You don't have to reteach the footwork. You can just say to them, the same inside pivot that we just did in the post, you do it here, and then you put your butt into the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go back into the post and you say, here's how we seal on a cross-court pass. And it's the same footwork, and it all started with that kid shooting the ball with an inside pivot.
Right. So I find it interesting that I think a lot of players and coaches probably think they or their players already know how to do these pivoting because it's so simple. But I'm curious, do you, you know, when you're working with NBA players and higher level players, do you still work on these pivots and these, you know, rudimentary back pivots and things like that? Or how important is it?
It's very important.
Yeah.
The level of players that I work at, a lot of the players that I work with have a similar profile.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Roger Bell came up after 3-4 years playing in the CBA. Bruce Bowen played in France for 3 years. These are guys that had to rely on really, really effective fundamentals because physically they're not as gifted as, say, Carmelo Anthony.
Right.
Okay. They reiterate to me constantly. I remember Raja saying to me, he said, I never thought about my feet until I went to camp with the Atlanta Hawks. And they worked a lot on not only footwork for getting shots, but footwork coming around screens and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But he had said that to me. There were guys that I have worked with, Rasul Butler, who has very good footwork, but we've been able to improve his footwork coming off the screens. And one of the common things about good players in the NBA, at least the ones that are not supremely talented, I mean the upper 5% of talent level, is that they have excellent footwork. Akeem Olajuwon down in the post, tremendous athlete, great quickness. You talk to anybody that play against him, the first thing that he says, that they say about him is great footwork in the post. You know who else has great? I mean, look at Tim Duncan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Great footwork in the post.
So what are some of the things these guys are doing with their feet to get shots and score in the post and things like that?
Well, Again, there are only a certain number of things you can do.
Right.
And, again, this may not answer your question directly, but I say the same thing to them that I say to kids, that when I go out and I have a shooting workout with Rajah Bell, okay, and our shooting workouts, just before he went to camp, okay, we were up to 650 makes in an hour and a half workout.
And that's a lot.
And we're talking about made shots.
That's a lot of shots.
Yes.
So how'd you get him to take so many shots? Was somebody constantly rebounding and getting the ball right back to him, or
pretty much me?
Yeah, you. So you got to work out too.
But also the nature of the drills that we do. I mean, I've developed a workout routine that enables us to do that.
Right.
Without really going nuts, which is a whole different interview.
Right.
But I say to them the same thing that I say to kids. What you think is a shooting drill, I think is a footwork drill. So when I work with Roger, okay, I very rarely make any comments at all about his shooting technique. But if he misses three or four shots in a row, immediately the first place I look at is at his feet. And then I'll try and dissect his rhythm a little bit. But he usually self-corrects.
Right.
You know, guys that I mean, Rasul has great footwork, as does Bruce. But I think at times it might even be more prevalent to the post, because basketball is a game of length and angles.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder why post guys, when they make moves to the basket, wind up going away from the basket, and it usually has to do with their footwork. But we don't look at that. As coaches, what we do is we say, you got to toughen up and you got to go after the contact and you got to lean in. Really, that's not it.
Yeah, so that's a mistake. You need to...
Yeah, it's poor footwork that forces them to step away from the basket instead of drive towards the basket.
Right.
And that creates...
So fix their feet instead of yelling at them and
yep.
telling them to make contact and
yep.
and stuff like that is basically what you're saying, right?
One of the things that we teach in the post is let's say drop steps. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
When you drop step, the foot that you drop step with, no matter where you are, it's direct line to the front of the rim. And we drill that, and we drill that, and we drill that, because in a game we're all as coaches we're familiar with the phrase game slippage.
Right.
Under pressure, is a player going to drop step directly at the basket? If he gets 10 attempts, we're lucky if he does it once.
Right.
But now when he doesn't step towards the basket, he's more on a direct line. He may get a better seal. He may get better rhythm. He may get fouled. He may have better opportunities to open up passing lanes, as opposed to watching him in practice as he drop steps, leaning away from the basket, because instead of stepping towards the rim, he stepped towards the foul line. If you could picture that, let's say we're doing a drop step to the middle on the left-hand side of the court, so his right foot is his pivot foot. Instead of stepping with his left foot towards the front of the rim, what he's doing, he's stepping with his left foot towards the foul line, which as he lifts his pivot foot to take his shot, is going to drive him away from the basket.
Right.
But instead of inspecting his footwork, what we do is we tell him to go after the contact and don't be afraid of the contact. Well, it's not that he's afraid of contact. Well, there are kids that are afraid of contact. But in most cases, that's not the issue. In most cases, he's stepping away from the basket, so he has no choice but to go away from the basket.
Right, so you just need to understand the proper footwork techniques and then drill the kids. And if you're a player, you know, come run your own drills and
right.
do that stuff in your living room and on the court and things like
right.
that. So that's good stuff.
Yeah, and I don't want to get off topic, but the point of the whole matter is that we need to teach our players not just why to do it, and not just what to do, but why we do it, and tell them it's going to make them a better player.
Right.
I mean, every time I hear a coach say to his player, we're going to do it this way because I'm the coach and you're the player and that's your job. I mean, I'd like to put a gun in my mouth. Because
it's just so much easier
to explain the whole process to a kid, and then he's going to go after it with such vigor that you're not going to be able to stop him.
Yeah, and part of the problem is sometimes the coaches just are simply they're ignorant, and they don't know why they're even doing what they're doing. Like you said, they've seen Bobby Knight yelling on the sidelines, and they see coaches in the NBA doing different things, so they try to mimic what they're doing instead of understanding the basics of the game.
And we're not saying that Bobby Knight is wrong, because obviously he's been very successful. People have to be
right. Who
they are.
Right.
But if you're developing who you are based upon what you see in other people, as opposed to what you feel is the best way for you to learn, you should always put yourself in a player's position, mentally. Always put yourself in, I mean, if this is how I was being taught, would this be effective for me? Would staying in a drill for 20 minutes because it's not being done to my satisfaction, if I were a player, would that be productive for me?
Yeah, that'll change your thought process, I'm sure, in a lot of things you do if you ask that question.
Absolutely. But I really think that the biggest thing is you have to realize that as you teach kids, that they are under stress. And really what you need to do is you need to try and find ways to relieve that stress, to allow players to learn and to grow and to excel, as opposed to thinking that a player is going to do it because of you. What your job is as a coach is to put him in a position where he can learn the best, and then he makes decisions whether or not he's going to learn or not. Nobody does anything because of you.
Mm-hmm.
All you can do is put the seeds in the pot, water it every day, and put it in a position where it can get sun every day, and then the plant's going to grow at its own speed.
Right.
And it's pretty much right. The same thing with players.
Yeah, and you told me something interesting yesterday, and I believe you're referring to Coach Nick Van Gundy and what he experienced with his youth team.
Stan Van Gundy.
Stan Van Gundy, okay. And what was the... Would you mind repeating what you told me yesterday and what he experienced with his kid?
What Stan had done the 2 years that he did not coach, okay, is he has an 11-year-old son now, or I believe he's 12, and he coached his son's basketball team. And he told me that he was shocked. I'd ask him how his team was doing. He says, "We're doing great, but we're not winning any games." He said he was shocked at all the parents that were coaching the other kids' teams. And they're in an 11-year-old league and 11-year-olds, most of them, have severe physical limitations. They haven't grown any strength yet. Their perceptions are still developing. Their space and time.
Their ball handling skills.
Yeah, they're all still developing. And he said that all the coaches in this youth league, what they would do is they would press and they would trap kids, not because the situation called for it. So they weren't teaching their kids situational basketball. But they would do it because they knew that an 11-year-old, if put in a trap in the corner, was not strong enough to throw the ball to a place where they could break the trap and be effective offensively.
Right.
But how is that benefiting these kids' skills, so when they're 14 years old, when they are strong enough to do it, they're not going to have the knowledge or the skills to be able to take advantage when somebody traps them in the corner.
Right. So I assume Van Gundy was doing more just teaching the game of basketball, perhaps in half court and different things like that.
He played man-to-man defense. He ran an offense where kids had a pass, they had a cut, and they had a screen.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do any isolation side screens. He didn't do any clear outs for his best players, because his objective was, if he had 10 kids on his team, he wanted all 10 kids to learn how to play the game.
Right. Yeah, it's something I see on a personal level, too, with so many coaches around here that do full court press and shooting threes and, you know, run and gun, and these kids, you know, they're just, they're not doing them any justice. They need to learn how to how to play in the half court and how to set screens and how to do these things. And then when they get up to high school, they may have had a lot of success and won a lot of games, but the trapping things that they've been doing and the bad habits they've developed don't work by the time they, you know, the kids get older and they're stronger and can get into high school, and it really hurts them in the long run, big time.
And then they don't know how to adjust. I think as coaches, we can't get caught up in the instant gratification situation. If you're coaching kids, you have to learn how to take pride and how to take satisfaction, not from successes that you have today, but the success that the kids that you worked with at 12, 13, 14 years of age, the success that they have when they're 18.
Right.
Now, you have to sit back and you have to wait for that. But it's much more satisfying. It's much more satisfying when you're sitting in a game and a kid that's 18 years old sticks four shots in a row. And you know that because you had him when he was 13 and you taught him shot selection, don't just pull up and take shots. We're not running a 13-year-old break to take threes when most of the kids can't even reach the basket. You taught him proper technique. You taught him that the number one thing in shot selection is to take shots you can make. And that kid goes out in a championship game when he's 18 years old and makes four shots that make a difference in the game. You have to take satisfaction in the fact that you taught him that. That's part of the process that you started when he was 12 or 13 years of age.
Right. Right.
He may not get that satisfaction when he's 13 years of age. He may come back at you and say, well, everybody else is shooting, why can't I? And you may lose a couple of youth league games because of that. But when it really matters, when it's really going to make a difference in a kid's life, you're part of that learning process.
Right.
And I think as coaches, we need to learn to take long-term views.
Yep. I wholeheartedly agree. And I think it's great to hear it coming from someone like yourself that's seen everything from the NBA to college and has been doing it for a long time. So it's definitely good to hear that reassurance. And
well, I haven't been doing it for a long time, but I'm sure I haven't done everything. And again, I want to reiterate, this is just what I believe.
Right. And I happen to agree with you on especially these youth concepts and things like that. So wholeheartedly.
But if coaches that are going to live, that are going to be exposed to this, don't believe that, that's fine too, because I'm sure you can teach me some things.
Right. Right.
There's no one way to do things. These are just things that I have learned to believe over the years that I've been doing this. And I really wholeheartedly believe it because I've seen positive results.
Right. That's definitely what it's all about, and what we're trying to do here is share information from other coaches and continually learn, so we can all get better coaches and become better players and things like that. So definitely appreciate, you know, all the comments and things. And if you don't mind, here we got a few more minutes where we could get into some of the mental aspects. And we've actually talked a lot about mental stuff, but maybe there's a couple of things we haven't quite gotten into that it may make sense to talk about, because I know you're big into the mental stuff and think that's very important for basketball. So do you have any some last mental tips that you have for players to improve their game?
Well, I just think, number one, we have to find ways to remove fear of failure.
Right.
There are, I believe, the two most important, I can't even say what I believe the two most important things, two most important words in the English language are, because they're frowned upon by society. But if I can give you an example and something that really, really shaped the way that I look at the game as well, is that when I played in college, I had the best job in the world. All I was supposed to do is come off the screens and shoot jump shots.
So you were the scorer.
If I tried to pass the ball to somebody, I would sit down. Okay. If I was open coming off the screen, I didn't get the ball, that guy would sit down.
Right.
And we were playing in a big rivalry game. And I was 0 for 10 in the first half. And I get the ball out on the wing, and I pass up a shot and pass it to somebody else. Next time down the floor, I'm open on the wing. I get the ball, and I pass up a shot and throw it to somebody on the wing. And sure enough, the buzzer sounds, and I'm on the bench.
Right.
I stayed on the floor through 0 for 10. I passed up two shots, and I sat down.
Mm-hmm.
I was the star of the halftime show. Okay? Coach just ripped me a new one. And the message was, what is your job? Well, my job is to come off screens on the wing and shoot the ball. So why do you have that job? Because I'm good at it. Okay. How'd you get good at it? Well, I worked hours and hours and hours, and I outworked other people to get that job. So he says, why did you stop shooting? I said, I'm 0 for 10. I'm hurting the team. And he looks at me and he says, you might be 0 for 10, but you're doing your job. He says, if you stop shooting, now you're not doing your job. Then you start hurting the team. And then he said something that stayed with me forever. He looked at me and he said, are you good enough to do this? And I said, yeah. He said, you tell me how many are going to go in if you don't shoot any. And I understood that he had confidence, enough confidence in me, that I didn't forget how to shoot. They just didn't go in.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me enough confidence to know that even if I was missing shots, I was going to stay in the game because that's my job and because we both believed that I was the best at it. I went out and I shot 10 for 12 in the second half. Had he not done that, I would have went out on the floor if I had gone out on the floor. But when I was out on the floor, I would be doubting what I could do and what I couldn't do.
Yeah, you'd have been hesitating and thinking about your shot.
You cannot fear failure.
So you can't worry about missing your shot when you're in the game. If you miss it, oh well.
Nope. Yep.
If it goes in, it goes in. You know that some will go in and some won't, and you might miss 10 in a row, but the next one could go in.
I use different words than oh well, but it's
pretty
good. Athletics is actually an exercise in failure. Okay? If you're a baseball player and you play for 15 years, and over your 15 years, you make out, okay, you're out 70% of the time, what do they call you?
A pretty good hitter.
They call you a Hall of Famer. You're a basketball player, okay, and using college standards now, okay, it's a little bit different in the pros, but even in the pros, okay, you shoot three-point shots and you miss 65% of the time, what do they call you?
Good three-point shooter.
Yeah, they call you a great shooter.
Turn.
You're missing 65% of the time. If your overall shooting percentage is 45%, so you miss 55% of the time, what do they call you? They call you a great shooter.
Right.
If you're going to put more emphasis on failures than you do on successes,
you're in trouble.
You're not going to survive.
Sure.
Sports is an exercise in failure. Anybody can handle success. It's the great ones that take the failures and realize that at some point success is going to follow that.
Right.
And they use their failures as a springboard. You can either run away from it or you can embrace it. Nobody wants to miss shots. Nobody wants to turn the ball over. Nobody wants to be on the foul line missing a foul shot at the end of a game. But unless you want to be in that situation, it's not going to happen.
Right.
And you have to be willing to accept the failures, which will be momentary, for long-term success. And if you wind up being a 45% shooter and people think you're a great shooter, you're still failing 55% of the time.
Right. So, yeah, most people don't think about it like that, though.
Yeah. But if you're gonna dwell more on those failures than you are on your success, you're never going to accomplish anything.
Right. Yep, that's a good point. I learned a while ago, and it worked well for me and may or may not work for others, but, you know, just to not think about your shot, get yourself relaxed. And the little thing that I used to do is whenever I took a shot, I'd just say, nice shot, I can do better. and just say it, you know, to myself, under my breath, and, you know, I didn't care if it went in or went out or not, and it kind of, that got me in the habit of getting into that mode or that zone or whatever you want to call it. So, hey, nice shot, you can do better. I wasn't so concerned if it went in. That little thing, you know, kind of helped me, and, you know, maybe it'll work for others, but everybody has to find their own thing that works for them, you know.
As a player, I invented analysis paralysis.
Yeah.
It's awful.
And right.
Paralysis. That another analogy that I use too is that, you know, and I've actually done this with pro guys. Okay, because there are some guys that I work with who really are great shooters, and they step to the foul line, and they can't make foul shots. I asked them, I said, "Why can't you make a foul shot?" I said, "That should embarrass you." He says, "Well, every time I step to the foul line and I miss, I start to make adjustments." I said, "That you've been in the NBA for 14 years. How many foul shots do you think you've taken through your life?" He said, "Hundreds of thousands." I said, "If you miss one, what makes you think that you forgot how to shoot?" And the thing is, if every time you miss, you try and make an adjustment, now you're trying to learn multiple shots. It's hard enough to master one shot. So you don't change. And the analogy that I use is that if you're walking down the street and you trip and you fall, what do you do? Well, you get up and you start walking again. Well, when you walk, do you stand there and you say, "Okay, let me put my left foot forward, right foot forward, left foot forward"? No, I just walk.
You don't
even think about it. It's unconscious. So
yeah.
You've taken hundreds of thousands of foul shots in your life. So you miss one or you miss two, and you're going to sit there and you're going to go through your shot and examine, say, is my elbow in, the ball on my fingertips, am I following through correctly? Hundreds of thousands of foul shots. Just shoot it.
Yeah, just do it without thinking, and
you take your mind out of it.
It's like walking.
Yeah, you take your mind out of it. Your body's going to know what to do.
Yeah, you've done it enough times and you've practiced enough that it's like walk. Shooting's like walking. That's partly why practice is so important.
For some of us, we shoot better than we walk. but the process is the same. You could go for miles and miles and miles and not once think about the process of walking.
Right.
Should be the same when you shoot. Should be the same when you dribble.
Absolutely. That's definitely interesting something that I haven't really thought about too much myself, at least to that level. So that's a good analogy, the walking and shooting. Are there any other, just a couple quick, before we wrap things up here, a couple quick mental tips that you think would be good to...
I'll give you one more story.
Okay.
Because I'm a big believer, for those of us who know that your body and your mind, your body cannot tell the difference between reality and fantasy. That we've all had dreams where we're being chased and keep falling down, and then you wake up out of your dream and you're sweating and your heart is racing because while you were going through that dream, your body thought it was real. And it's a conscious decision for you to determine what's real and what's not real. Those of us that can't do that, the term is insanity, but that's the definition of insanity. Okay. There was a guy that I was exposed to in college. His name was Dick Fecto. And he was held in solitary confinement in North Korea for 18 years from the Korean War. And when they finally released him, they asked him how he kept his sanity. And what he said just astounded me. He said, "They would wake me up in the morning, I would eat breakfast, and then I would close my eyes, and I would play my favorite golf course. I would play 18 holes in my mind." He said, that would take 5 hours. Time came for another meal. After that meal, I would play another 18 holes. So that's 10 hours out of the day. And then I would sleep. So I did that every day for 18 years.
Wow.
Okay. He finally got released and went home. Okay. And the first time he went out to his favorite golf course, he shot a 74. After 18 years in solitary confinement. Now, we've all, for those of us who play golf, and for those of us who have to live in winter, like people in Iowa,
yeah.
You go out and you say, and those of us who are golfers, we go out and the first couple of rounds that we play are always the best. And then we start to regress. And the reason for that is during the entire winter, we're thinking about doing the right things in golf. When I was up in New Hampshire during the 12 months of winter, I was always thinking about playing golf during the 2 weeks of summer that we had. Yeah. And I would get out the first day and I would hit the ball very well. And then I'd start to spiral downward once I didn't hit the ball well and I started to get some negative feedback. Is that mental aspects, when you sit, I'm very, very big on mental imagery.
Okay.
Okay. Mental imagery does not give you negative feedback. It's always successful.
And mental imagery is basically kind of visualizing success, essentially?
Yes.
Visualizing hitting the ball and making it, shooting the ball and making it?
Yep. Now, you won't become a good foul shooter by not practicing, okay? But you will be a better foul shooter if before you go to sleep, you close your eyes and you picture yourself taking 20 perfect foul shots and feeling all the things that it takes to shoot foul shots.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't take the place of practicing. But if you add that into your practice regimen, you get better.
Right.
And another great illustration, I do this with kids, is you have them close their eyes in a dark room and you tell them a story, putting them in their favorite uniform, playing for their favorite team, hitting a shot to win the championship at the buzzer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Two things will happen. Okay. First of all, nobody will miss. Nobody ever misses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Second thing is, you ask them, did you feel it? Did your hair stand up on end? The hair on the back of your neck stand up? Did you get a chill? Feel your heart. Is your heart racing right now? Because your body does not know the difference between reality and fantasy. That's all controlled by your mind.
Right.
So if you can train your mind to get out of your body's way, things work better.
Right. Getting in the zone, into that correct state, is definitely a powerful thing to do.
When you're in,
or whatever you want to call it.
When you're in the zone, you have no fear of failure. Your perceptual field gets larger because you have no stress. Everything slows down for you. You have tons of time to do whatever it is you want to do.
Yep. Your mind is clear.
Yep. But when you miss five shots in a row, if you're going to stand there and you're going to examine every piece of every shot you take, analysis paralysis, you have no chance. It's like laying in bed, telling yourself to go to sleep, and you wind up being more awake.
Yep.
Same process. Yep.
All right. Well, that's definitely great stuff to think about and take home and apply. And definitely appreciate your time and all your information here. And hopefully we can talk more in the future and keep the great information coming.
Well, my pleasure. Anything I do to help you, just let me know.
Okay. It's much appreciated. And then we'll talk to you later, Don.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.